This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode, The Hidden Cost of Science. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. What do you do when you want to contribute to solutions, but then you realize you're actually part of the problem? Grant Hill has this story about the impact of doing environmental research.
Stephanie Burrell is an ecologist who studies seabirds, and sometimes that involves figuring out how they died. And in this process, she found something alarming.
I would collect birds from the beaches as they get blown in from storms. And when we dissected them, they were full of plastic. The little pre-production pellets, bits of plastic, bric-a-brac, Coca-Cola bottle rings.
Now, this wasn't exactly a new discovery. Researchers first observed the ingestion of plastic by marine animals all the way back in the 60s, and subsequent studies have shed even more light on the impact of plastic pollution in the ocean.
The ocean is full of plastic.
Evidently, human beings really are addicted to plastic and material.
In an underwater paradise, a plastic nightmare.
But despite reports and studies, experts never really set a target limit for global plastic pollution. So, Stephanie and a team of researchers set out to discover whether our current efforts, including international resolutions and initiatives to phase out plastic production and reduce waste, could successfully scale down marine plastic pollution back to what it was in 2010, an estimated 8 million metric tons per year. That's 8 million small cars worth of plastic ocean litter a year. That was the goal.
I couldn't kind of believe the results for a long time.
The short answer is no, and by a wide margin. Stephanie's study showed that by the end of this year alone, 24 to 35 million metric tons of plastic will find its way into our waters. And if nothing changes, by 2030, that number could jump to nearly 90 million per year.
I just couldn't fathom that. That was reality, but I don't even know how to give you an analogy that can make it easier to comprehend. It is just an enormous amount of plastic.
In the face of such a seemingly insurmountable problem, Stephanie realized that even her own scientific work had contributed to this issue.
I used a lot of plastic, and it's kind of unavoidable, you know. I was collecting samples from islands and having to store them into small plastic containers. And I did my best to sort of reuse them as many times as possible, but there's only so much you can do. And yeah, it was kind of awful, to be honest. I felt really guilty about it.
The problem is that the same physical properties that make plastic so harmful to the environment also make it really useful for conducting scientific research.
You know, they can be rigid, they can be flexible. They're really durable, so they don't melt or degrade very easily.
Oh, and another thing, plastic is cheap, which makes it disposable.
Everything's like single use, single use, single use.
Eli Preston manages a developmental genetics lab at the University of Pennsylvania.
In labs, you want it to be sterile and you want to save time.
That means it's usually easier, faster, and cheaper to just break out a brand new plastic pipette rather than clean one that's dirty. Eli was frustrated by how much plastic trash was piling up.
I just wanted to cut down on the huge amounts of waste that our lab produces.
So Eli set out to convince researchers at their university to make a change. They created a program to purchase reusable glass Petri dishes and produced a video showing exactly how to clean them. While Eli's initiative garnered attention from people all over the world, other labs at their own university have yet to sign on.
I feel like scientists can be really, they're really focused. You know, science is hard, and they don't want things that might, you know, slow them down or just be a change that they don't know about.
Sometimes moving the needle even a tiny bit seems next to impossible. And other times, you're in for a pleasant surprise. Take the high-tech freezers that scientists use to store their samples, another staple in labs. They are huge energy hounds and can account for up to a quarter of all energy use on campus.
You cannot turn freezers off. They're required 24/7. But some initiatives early on that we worked on was the temperature choice of the freezers.
That's Catherine Ramirez Aguilar.
I manage the Green Laboratories program at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Catherine started thinking about science's sustainability problem over a decade ago, and she was surprised to find out that sustainability just wasn't on many researchers' radars.
At most, there were stickers on the light switches asking us to turn off the lights.
And that was a problem, because research labs use a lot of energy, even when no one's using them. And that's mostly because of all those freezers. They're always on. And the technology has gotten so good, they can get so cold, that many researchers just began turning the temperature way down because, well, they could. So Catherine and her colleagues started asking scientists, can your sample survive at negative 70 degrees Celsius or negative 60 or negative 50 rather than negative 80?
We created a freezer challenge because we wanted to create a competition, and we wanted to have competition between our institutions.
The idea caught on online. More and more research institutions began signing up, and in the past 3 years, the challenge has saved enough energy to offset the carbon emissions of driving over 15 million miles. That's like 8 years worth of NASCAR erased. And the companies that produce freezers are taking notice.
The market for freezers, especially ultra-low temperature freezers, has shifted so quickly because the pressure is rising to do that on those industries.
For a while, plastic pollution researcher Stephanie Burrell was also hoping that the market would shift to reduce plastic trash, that armed with research like hers, global leaders and policymakers would recognize the rising tide of pollution and all the bird bellies full of trash and turn course. But now she's moved on from hope.
I think about hope as being it's a very passive word. It implies that someone else is going to come and fix the problem, that we don't have to do anything else. Whereas I sort of feel like when I've lost all hope is that it's actually now manifested as determination. And determination to me reflects action.
For Stephanie, that means continuing her efforts to quantify the problem so science and citizens can do something about it.
Every action that I take makes a difference. Every action that everybody else takes makes a difference. Every conversation that we have about this issue shines a light on it and draws attention to it. And so that's how movements happen. That's how things change.
That story was reported by Grant Hill.